I bid you good morning. We have some folks visiting with us. Back on the right are the Burlesons that are visiting with us. And also in the back on the right, behind Gayla, are friends of mine, Justin and Christian. They're guys who work at the gym where Cindy and I go, and they've seen fit to come worship God with us this morning and to encourage me as I try to present a message from God's Word. I'm not the regular evangelist here. As many of you know, we're in the process of looking for a preacher, and I'm just a guy trying to serve my God and to serve my fellow man and to please my Lord. So that's what I'm going to do this morning in the presentation of His Word. If you could see a trailer about today's sermon, you'd hear things like it's going to include quotes from Ralph Waldo Emerson. It's going to include a quote from Heraclitus, who's a 6th century philosopher. Also a quote from Brené Brown, if any of these names are familiar to you. We're going to talk about Steph Curry. I'm going to present to you three hypotheses. That's a fun word to say, hypotheses. And the sermon actually includes some audience participation, and that makes the elders uncomfortable when you say that. Let's get started. Nick, that can't happen. I got no clickology happening. Ah, good. He gave me control. Thank you, sir. Okay, so I've entitled our lesson, Our Spiritual Identity Crisis. Each of those words are important, and you'll see them unfold as we talk more about the lesson's content. But I want to begin with some audience participation. If you are never going to sin again, please raise your hand. Now please look around and see how many hands are up. You see, the key is to note here that most of us, and yea, every person in this auditorium, thinks that there's a good chance we're going to sin again at some point before we die. We have a problem. Okay, and here's some more audience participation. Vinny, would you stand up and read as loudly as you can for us, please, the scriptures that I've asked you to. Here's our problem from the scripture. Thank you, Vinny. So we have a problem. This problem is not new or unique to you, but it's foundational to our conversation this morning. All of us have sinned. All of mankind throughout all of time has committed sin. And the wages of that sin, what's due to us in return for our sin, is death. Now, it's important for us to point out that we're not talking about physical death. We're talking about the second death, the eternal death. Revelation 21:8 points out for us, but for the cowardly, the unbelieving, the abominable, the murderers, immoral persons, sorcerers, idolaters, all liars, their part will be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. This second death is what's being referred to in Romans 6:23. Okay, but this is a problem. It's a long-standing problem. It's the fall of man, and it's been the case since the Garden of Eden. The problem manifests itself to us in what I'm referring to as crisis situations. So I'm trying to draw our attention to the difference between the problem and a crisis situation. Well, to do that, first let's look at a definition for crisis. Crisis is a noun, and another fun translation in the plural is a crises. When you have many of those, it's a time of intense difficulty, trouble, or danger, like the current economic crisis if we were having one, which we're not. Synonyms would be a catastrophe, a calamity, a cataclysm, emergency, or disaster. The definition that we're going to use for our discussion today is the one that's at the bottom. a time when a difficult or an important decision must be made. That's the crisis that we're going to be talking about. It is, as is commonly referred to, the heat of the moment. It's that critical decision point that we make when we choose consciously sin. So, the contrast is our long-standing problem, the fall of man, versus the crisis, the heat of the moment. And we're going to try to prepare for these heat of the moment crises. My first hypothesis this morning is that if I understand how this problem, this long-standing problem, becomes a crisis, then I'll be able to avoid the crisis altogether. One reason that our problem can become a crisis is a lack of preparation. Many of you will recognize this guy. His name is Steph Curry. If you follow any kind of sports or read any kind of paper, you've probably heard about him. He's the best shooter that the NBA has ever seen. Think about how many people have tried to be a good shooter in the NBA. How many kids? How many college kids? Okay, and the reason that I draw attention to him is not for any moral character about this guy, but simply he is the best that has ever been at what he has chosen to do. So it's likely worthy of some study. Let's read a little bit of the article together. The two-time MVP, that stands for the most valuable player, the two-time MVP and three-time champion, is on pace to shatter the all-time record for made threes, that's three-pointers. His ability to shoot from any distance off the dribble has forced both defenses and other offenses to change their schemes. Curry's rise to becoming the best shooter in the NBA comes from a pattern of hard work and intense preparation that has paid off. Okay, this is our key point in preparation. The article goes on to read, though Curry is now 6'3", he was a late bloomer. Before he grew, he reportedly used to shoot a sort of a flick shot that released from his chest. As his competition got bigger and better, Dell, which is his father and a former NBA player as well, he helped Steph change his shooting form so that his release point was above his head. He had to relearn how to shoot the ball. Now, in the middle of the article, what I've left out is there were times when Dell, Steph's father, would actually walk out of the gymnasium in eighth grade, freshman year. You know why he'd walk out? Because he was embarrassed that his son was absolutely destroying the competition, making them look silly. And he didn't like that his son, after scoring 40 or 50 points in a game, would come over to his dad, and his dad would have to acknowledge to all those other parents, yeah, that was my boy who just destroyed your kid. So his dad would actually leave the gym. So despite that level of success, Steph Curry, his freshman summer, I think, had to relearn the number one skill in basketball, how to shoot it. Okay? Curry told Sports Illustrated's Chris Ballard, it was the most frustrating summer, saying, I really couldn't shoot outside of the paint for the first 3 weeks. All summer, when I was at camps, people would say, who are you and why are you playing basketball? I was really that bad for a month and a half before I figured it out. So the point here is that even the very best on the planet at what he's choosing to do had to go back and relearn things, restudy his craft. He had to learn how to prepare once again. Athletes train to be ready. Workers get degrees 4, 6, 8, 10 years sometimes of preparation to be ready. They'll have to study for and pass medical exams, we hope. Ask a college kid recently about their semester that they just finished and what their worst class was. They'll tell you, it's hard. It takes effort. So as we consider this response to our crises of sin, young people, you know that you're going to be confronted with things like sex, drugs, sex outside of marriage, drugs, alcohol, profanity. They're all coming your way. You know that if they haven't already come your way. You simply need to be prepared for them. You need to spend time thinking about what you will do in advance of those situations so that when they come, you can avoid the crisis situation, the heat of the moment, where you hope that you'll make a good decision. You don't need to hope. Let's prepare for that situation. And we're going to talk significantly more about how to prepare in just a minute. Perhaps another moment of reflection. We all allocate significant time to develop our skills and our abilities and our strategies for the things that we love. Our sports, our music. Think about how much time you as a musician spend practicing your practicing your music. I'm left asking myself, well, what about my spiritual skills and abilities and strategies? What's my spiritual training regimen? Was a challenging question that I posed to myself. Well, I came up with two more hypotheses that I want to share this morning in response to this concept of preparation. The first is limited preparation or training equals an increased risk for the crisis situation. And the converse of this is true. Increased preparation or training is actually crisis prevention, which is what I want. I don't want to sin. I don't want that threat of my soul being in jeopardy with my God. Now, and in the interest of time, because I'm the speaker, we're going to accept all three hypotheses this morning as being true. And we're going to jump right into some crisis prevention. So, yes, this is an identity crisis prevention, a spiritual identity crisis prevention class, if you will. The first thing in our first component of identity crisis prevention is to develop an emotional attachment to God. Yeah, to love Him. Now, I know that sounds pretty novel, right? Yeah, I got up Sunday morning and I went to church and the preacher man told me I need to love God. I know you already know that. But what I'm challenging you with is maybe a struggle that I have when I talk about or I think about my own love for my God. See, there's an intellectual loving of God. For example, while we were sinners in Romans 5 and verse 8, while we were sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. That's a profound statement. But to me, perhaps because I've heard it a lot, it seems a bit more intellectual to me. Another one in 1 John 4:19, we love because He first loved us. Very important, not trying to minimize it, but what I'm challenging you with is as a foundation for combating the crisis situation that we have with our spiritual identity is more of an emotional connection to your God. Okay, let me give you this scripture, for example. Psalms 139:13. For you, that's a capital Y, you God, for you formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. This stirs up emotion for me. The awareness that God knows who I am and actually had a part in forming me. It helps me appreciate my relationship to Him as the Creator and me being the created being. Again, in Jeremiah 1:5, He says, this is the Lord speaking, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. To me, that's amazing that He would care for me individually. Luke 12 and verse 7 says, indeed, the very hairs on your head are all numbered. That level of care and concern, knowledge about me, stirs up an emotional response to me toward my God that I think is foundational in our crisis prevention program. Okay, so now we're going to jump into who am I, actually, and we're going to try to establish our identity in combating the crisis situations. First off, we need to understand this spiritual identity. And the first component of that we want to consider this morning is you are a battleground. I didn't say you were on a battleground. You, the person you are, in fact, a battleground. This is one of the more challenging scriptures, so I ask you to engage it heartily, and I will stop intentionally as we read it. In Romans chapter 7, beginning at verse 14, "But I am of flesh, sold into bondage to sin. For what I'm doing, Paul writes, I do not understand. For I'm not practicing what I would like to do, but I'm doing the very thing that I hate." That's a reference to he's committing sin and struggling with the fleshly desires. Just to keep things simple on my slide, I'm jumping to verse 18. "For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is, in my flesh. For the willing is present in me, but the doing of good is not. For the good that I want, I do not do, but I practice the very evil that I do not want. But if I am doing the very thing that I do not want, I'm no longer the one doing it, but sin which dwells in me." Paul's helping us appreciate the struggle that happens inside us. We have fleshly desires, but we are a spiritual being. Fulfilling those fleshly desires in an unlawful or unauthorized manner creates the crisis situation for us. Again, in Romans 8, Paul continues to write, "For the mind set on the flesh is death, but the mind set on the spirit is life and peace." And finally, in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 17, "For the flesh sets its desire against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. For these are in opposition to one another, so that you may not do the things that you please." So, we need to understand in our spiritual identity that there's a struggle, as the scriptures point out for us, that you are a battleground. So acknowledge that. Embrace that concept. And that should provoke us to put forth effort to be prepared to deal with the crisis that comes our way. To be prepared for the heat of the moment. Okay, so you're a battleground. That's the first component of our spiritual identity. You were purchased. In 1 Corinthians 6, 19 and 20, it says, "You are not your own, for you have been bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body." This concept of being purchased, it creates within us a responsibility. We are responsible as a result to yield to His will. And sometimes we don't like that. Sometimes we don't want to yield to anybody. We live in America. Who do I need to yield to? Who is this that I should yield to Him? Does that sound familiar? Exodus chapter 5. Pharaoh. Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey His voice to let Israel go? I don't know the Lord, and besides, I'm not letting Israel go." This first part of the scripture, "You are not your own." Let that sink in as part of your spiritual identity because it's foundational. You've been purchased with a price. You have now responsibilities to the one who has purchased you. We press on. In our spiritual identity, you need to understand that you are a temple. In the Old Testament, many of us understand, what was the temple? It was the dwelling place of God. That's where He was. Today, on this side of the cross, in the New Testament, we are the temple. God lives here, inside of me. 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 16 says, "Do you not know that you are a temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwells in you?" I'd like you to engage this visual. It's been said that a picture paints a thousand words. If you'll notice what's happening here, if you could look inside of the human mind, you'd see that the thing that it absolutely, completely fills the human mind is a picture of supposedly Christ sitting on the throne of our heart or our mind. The implication would be that every action, every thought, every deed, every motive, is governed by Christ, the one who purchased us. We're supposed to be, our identity is supposed to be observable as being a temple of God. That is who I am. That is part of my identity. The last component of our spiritual identity that I want to present with you, to you this morning, is that you are an heir. An heir. Being an heir is cool. What it means is, in a simple sense, the generation before me, if there's any assets, money left over, when they pass on, it'll become mine. There's an inheritance. Okay, but our inheritance is far more valuable as a Christian. Romans chapter 8, beginning at verse 12, says, "So then, brethren, we are under obligation." Remember, previously we were talking about our responsibilities. "We are under obligation not to the flesh to live according to the flesh." Verse 13, "For if you are living according to the flesh, you must die. But if by the Spirit you are putting to death the deeds of the body, you will live. For all who are being led by the Spirit of God, these are sons of God. For you have not received a spirit of slavery, leading to fear again, but you have received a spirit of adoption as sons, by which we cry out, Abba, Father." Abba, Father simply means Father, Father. It's a term of honor and glorification. So, Father, Father, "the Spirit Himself testifies with our spirit that we are children of God, and if we are children, heirs also. Heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with Him, so that we may also be glorified." You can see the part that I have highlighted behind me. We have been adopted as heirs. We are children of His. Heirs, fellow heirs with Christ. I told you I liked the visual that I had in the last slide. I couldn't come up with a visual that would represent this. What does that mean to be a joint heir with Christ? We all understand that He came to earth and has returned to heaven. He's residing at the right hand of God right now. Those spiritual blessings in heaven that belong to Christ are mine as well. That's unbelievable to me. We are fellow heirs with Christ. That is the anchor of our spiritual identity in helping us avoid the crisis situation. The key point here is you do not have to obey your flesh. You do not. You're a joint heir. And I'm reminded of the song, the statement from the song, "My Father owns it all, including me." I want to make a point here before we get into our last point about vulnerability. I want to invite you to make yourself vulnerable for a minute to engage the last point. Being vulnerable means you're susceptible to physical or emotional attack or harm. Synonyms are being unsafe, unprotected, unguarded, exposed. You let your guard down. That's what I want you to do right now, because we're experts at rationalizing things. What I'm going to do in this next moment is I'm going to suggest perhaps that there's something that you might be doing wrong or that you might need to improve. Right? The ninja comes out in us. You cannot say I'm doing something wrong. Let your guard down. Engage the concept for just a minute. Vulnerability, it's been said by Brené Brown, is our most accurate measurement of our courage. We think weak and vulnerable. We think strong and courageous. But in fact, what Brené has helped us see in this quote is that vulnerability is the right measure of our courage. If we would choose to be courageous, then we must first allow ourselves to be vulnerable and put the guard down. Okay, the last component of crisis prevention is we need to begin covenant making. Well, what are you talking about, Rod? What's a covenant? A covenant, if you don't know, is simply an agreement. But this is a unique kind of agreement that we're talking about this morning. In our context, it's a commitment to change who I am. Not only to change who I am, but it's a commitment to myself to change who I am. Job, in Job 31:1, he made a commitment to himself. He said, I made a commitment with my eyes not to look lustfully at a young woman. Now, as we engage the concept and we let our, to help us let our guard down, I want to remind you of just a few passages. In Psalm 44 and 21, would not God find this out? For he knows the secrets of the heart, in Luke 16 and 15. And he said to them, you are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God. Hebrews 4 and verse 13 says, all things are open and laid before the eyes of him. And finally in Acts 15 and verse 8, and God who knows the heart. The point is, as we try to be vulnerable, we try to let our guard down, the truth, and we look for opportunities, covenants that we need to make, God already knows. The scriptures have borne it out for us. God already knows those spiritual weaknesses that we have. So here's the key question at the top of the slide. Where do I need to make a covenant? What is my current spiritual weakness? Wouldn't that be cool if you got up to go to church this morning and you actually left better prepared to avoid a spiritual crisis than you were when you came? Well, you can, but only if you actually engage and identify the thing that you want to make a covenant with yourself about. What is it? I'm going to pause here. You be honest with you. Rod's funny handshake of Rod. You be honest with you. Where do you need to make a covenant? And make it now, mentally. That's all that it is. And what we're doing when we do that is we're acknowledging that we're at a fork in the road right now. Whatever that thing is, you tell me. Is it profanity? Is it drugs? Is it alcohol? We just finished tax season. How'd that go for you? What decisions did you make regarding your taxes? How about the business dealings? How about a simple lie to your mom and dad? Okay, this is you. It represents you figuratively. Going to the left is choosing the old ways. To let that sermon and this preacher who's in the pulpit and the blah, blah, blah go right by you one more day. That's option one. Option two is actually to engage the change and to make a new covenant with yourself so that you can avoid the crisis situation. If you will do that, if you have done that, then what you've done is you've just improved your character. That's how it happens. You stand up and you say, what was in my life doesn't belong there anymore. I acknowledge that. I'm sorry, and I'm removing it, whatever it is. Or, if there are things that you've been leaving out, I'm going to start doing that thing today. Tomorrow. Make that commitment. Heraclitus is the one who coined the phrase, our character is our destiny. This refinement process that we're talking about and making a covenant with yourself and keeping that commitment, it ultimately defines your destiny. This has been said oftentimes in many pulpits by Ralph Waldo Emerson. I wish I could say that easily. Sow a thought and you reap an action. Sow an act and you reap a habit. Sow a habit and you reap a character. Sow a character and you reap a destiny. Controlling our thoughts, being prepared for a spiritual crisis, in fact, determines our destiny. In quick review of our spiritual identity crisis prevention, I suggest that you need to develop an emotional attachment to God beyond the intellectual. You need to understand your spiritual identity, that you are a battleground. Don't be surprised by that. You were purchased. You are a temple where God dwells. You're an heir, a joint heir with Christ. This is your spiritual identity. And finally, in the battle, begin covenant making, the honest assessment. Reshape your character by making those commitments. The final passage that we'll consider this morning comes from Romans chapter 8, verse 15. Abba, Father, the Spirit Himself testifies with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, heirs also, heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with Him, so that we may also be glorified with Him. Abba, Father, I'm an heir. I'm an heir to the King. As you consider the things that we've talked about this morning, I hope they've been somewhat helpful to you. At this time, we offer the opportunity for any who would like to put on their Lord in baptism to do just that. We have clothes prepared. There's a baptistry behind me full of warm water. There's a room full of people who would like nothing more than to see you put on your Lord in baptism. If you've been considering that, boy, what's in your way? Is it your own pride? Would you let the devil win one more time? Why? All that you need to do is step out onto the aisle and come forward. And if there are things in your life that stand between you and God that you've failed in the spiritual identity crisis situations, make that right with your God, yourself, in prayer. Whatever your need is, if you'd like assistance of the church here, please let us know by coming forward as we together stand and sing this song for your invitation.